Dear Heavenly Father, we just thank you for this day. Thank you for this time. Thank you for a place to meet and how much we take for granted, Lord. And we just pray that this morning, that again, it would be a lesson for us today, that we wouldn't, although, you know, studying your word is always fruitful, that it wouldn't just be to study your word. It would be to draw closer to you and learn more about you. And thank you for your love letter that you wrote to us. In Jesus' name, amen. So I kind of wanted to go back because I think this is going to kind of end up being a theme through here as we get into this. Again, we saw the promises, the Davidic covenant is what it's called, all the promises God gave to David. And so I just wanted to reiterate that. This is found in Luke chapter 1, verses 26 through 28. In the sixth month, the angel Gabriel was sent out from God to a city in Galilee named Nazareth to a virgin betrothed to a man whose name was Joseph of the house of David. Very important. And the virgin's name was Mary. And he came to her and said, "Greetings, O favored one, the Lord is with you." But she was greatly troubled at the saying and tried to discern what sort of greeting this might be. And the angel said to her, "Do not be afraid, Mary, for you have found favor with God. And behold, you will conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus, and he will be great and will be called the Son of the Most High, and the Lord God will give him the throne of his father David, and he will reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there will be no end." I'll skip the last little bit there. But again, so we want to reiterate that that is why we are kind of, you know, going through Samuel and understanding the throne of David and how important. So it's kind of, I mean, at the time when the angel said this to Mary, did the throne of David exist in Israel? No, there was no king. So, I mean, you either believe this for what it says, or you make it an allegory or something, or there will be a throne that Jesus will sit on, and it will be the throne of David. So just thought we kind of start, go back, refresh with that that's what we're going to keep. This is kind of weird because we're going through the part, David's going to reach a apex early in the book of 2 Samuel, and then we'll kind of, from then on, it's kind of, on one hand, it's a kind of a descent, but there's little moments of, but David, we call him a man after God's own heart, and I think sometimes when we say, well, this guy committed murder, adultery, all this stuff, well, I think more the heart is that if you see his heart, the contriteness of his heart when he is shown these things, as opposed to like Saul. Every time Saul was confronted with, "Hey, you did this bad thing," he's like, "Oh, it's because the people, they made me do it." It was always, and as human beings, we could just about rationalize anything. And, you know, here I think in David's case, he's willing to internalize and look at himself and repent. And I think that's the big difference. So in 2 Samuel 8, this is where we were last week. So in the course of time, David defeated the Philistines and subdued them, and he took Metheg, Emma, from the control of the Philistines. David also defeated the Moabites. He made them lie down on the ground and measured them off with a length of cord. Every two lengths of them were put to death, and the third length was allowed to live. So the Moabites became subject to David and were brought him tribute. Here's a trivia question. Do you know where the term decimate came from? Just a fun trivia. The Roman legion, if you attacked and failed, they would line up the legion and every tenth man was killed. And that was called, that was decim. So that was to decimate the army, was to take that. If you failed, every tenth man was killed. So that kept them pretty motivated, let's say. So here you can see David's kind of a little ahead of his time, but he's doing a two-thirds. That's kind of, it is what it is. Moreover, David defeated Hadadezer, son of Rahab, king of Zobah, when he went to restore his monument at the Euphrates River. So, from what I can gather, I looked at this a little bit. This king's kind of at war with another king, and that king rebelled and tore down a statue, and he was going after that king, and David thought it was a great time. So he went after and kind of attacked the army that he'd left in his rear and rolled him up. So, and I have a map, if anyone's interested, we'll get to it, and we'll kind of look at what David did compared to Saul and stuff. So David captured 1,000 of his chariots, 7,000 charioteers, and 20,000 foot soldiers. He hamstrung all but 100 of his chariots. So we had a conversation with Mike last week about that he really, we read the law that said you weren't allowed to, kings should not bring horses or chariots, should not be multiplied to them. So you could make the case here that he's kind of sticking to that law.
Now, did he leave those that he didn't hamstring to, because they've done that in the past, left the armies not totally desolate so they can protect themselves? So did they leave the chariots them some protection against their other enemies, knowing that they were subject to Israel?
That's always a possibility.
Well, verses. So in this one it says he spared enough of them for 100 chariots.
So
that's why you might be getting, like, that one doesn't.
Says it took down, hamstrung all but 100. So I don't know. You know, I don't. Maybe he's, I don't know. This is one of those. Is he kind of walking the line and he's saying, well, I'm not really multiplying. And again, same kind of thing that you were saying. It's exactly what we had to do with Japan after World War II.
Yes.
We had to occupy Japan and protect them because they were defenseless because they had been defeated. So.
And he left them.
And he left them enough to take care of themselves, which we can't seem to do in Europe.
We can't seem to do it.
He put garrisons in the Aramean kingdom of Damascus, and the Arameans became subject to him and brought him tribute, and the Lord gave David victory wherever he went. David took the gold shields that belonged to the officers of Hadadezer and brought them to Jerusalem from Teba and Berothi. Sorry about the pronunciations. Towns that belonged to Hadadezer. King David took a great quantity of bronze. When Tua, king of Hamath, heard that David had defeated the entire army of Hadadezer, he sent his son Joram to King David to greet him and congratulate him on his victory of battle over Hadadezer, who had been at war with Tua, and Joram brought him articles of silver and gold. So see another case of the, you know, enemy of my enemy is my friend. And I know that's way overquoted, but it's just reality sometimes. So King David dedicated these articles to the Lord, as he had done with the silver and gold from all the nations he had subdued: Edom and Moab, the Ammonites, the Philistines, Amalek. He also dedicated the plunder taken from Hadadezer, son Rahab, king of Zobah. And David became famous after he returned from striking down 18,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt. So I think here we go. Oh, shoot. I'm sorry. So here is the... Come on. Maybe not. As you can see, we are at it. Oh, it'll go back. There we are. So this is to get a feel. I know you can't read everything, and I tried to make it big enough to see, but sometimes if you make it too big, it gets a little blurry. The yellow part down in the left center, kind of, that is where that is called Philistia, where the Philistines were. Actually, to get started out, the purple part in the middle is what Saul controlled. The green part is what David expanded the kingdom into. And you can see, if I wish you could read this. So up here, when David defeats this Hadazer, up here they were mining bronze. There you go, up here in this middle top. Sorry, that's not even staying anywhere near my... Just wandering around. Headed for the promised land. Anyway, right up there is where all the bronze was mined. And eventually, that's where David brings all this bronze down, which is, if anybody knows anything about bronze, it's called the metal that can withstand heat. So it was used for the great labor in the temple, and some of the altars were built of bronze because the bronze could stand great amounts of heat and not warp, misshape, that kind of thing. So here we see David kind of defeats him once, and then he goes down here and he gathers up another army, and he gets defeated. Sorry about this. Gets defeated again, and then here's where David defeats the Edomites. We can see Ammon here. The land of Tob is kind of here in the middle. Sorry, this is just not going to work. But yeah, so David defeats. I have to talk about where my pointer goes on its own. So that's the second battle that he's defeated. That's kind of Ammon, which we know as Jordan now, Ammon. And it's kind of interesting how a lot of these places have kept their name. And we'll see here, all the way down here at the bottom, this is the Valley of Salt, the bottom right side there, the arrow. Sorry, which maybe I'll print it out. If anybody wants it, you can read it. This is where David defeats the Edomites, and the king flees to Egypt. So this right at the bottom of the Dead Sea, obviously because the Dead Sea is loaded with high salt content, this is called, is my pointer getting there? Right there at the bottom of the larger body of water at the bottom in the middle, that's the actual Valley of Salt. And that's where the battle starts, and then, as you can see, chased them a little farther south, completely defeated them, and the king fled to Egypt. So just to give you kind of an idea, it's kind of interesting that what is called Philistia here is actually the Gaza Strip now. So we're seeing this replayed out every day in the news. It's the same couple thousand-year-old story. So I thought that might help just to see how much he expanded the kingdom. You know, we always know the Moabites and the Edomites were kind of like cousins, would you call? They were illegitimate.
Well, Edom was a brother.
Right. And then
Moab
and
incest
and
Lot's daughter.
So a stepbrother and a cousin. So it's kind of interesting that they're semi-related, but it's they were never friends, and you'll see later as Israel goes into captivity, they even celebrate, which brings judgment on them eventually. So to end that chapter, he put garrisons throughout Edom, and all the Edomites became subject to David, and the Lord gave David victory wherever he went. David reigned over all Israel, doing what was just and right for all his people. And that is, oh, I'm sorry, it hasn't flipped yet. So, but verse 14, I'll just read it till it catches up. Again, he put garrisons through Edom, and all the Edomites became subject to David, and the Lord gave David victory wherever he went. There it is. And David reigned over Israel, doing what was just and right for all his people. And that's like the most important thing, I guess, in kingship. So we always, growing up the way we did, we see, and we don't have a democracy, we have a representative republic. Everybody should remember that. Democracy is mob rule. But we feel like that's like the best form of human government. And maybe to an extent it is. But actually the best form of human government is a monarchy with a righteous and just monarch on the throne. Then decisions are easily made, the right decision is easily made, and there's no questioning of, what's, but again, I know we've grown up and, you know, my dad was a World War II vet. We saluted the flag and did everything we did. And, you know, we grew up believing America was the greatest, and as hurtful as it is when you have your paradigm shattered, we've seen that maybe the country we thought we had, we don't really have. And I don't know what time it stopped being that, but it isn't. So, verse 16, here I stumbled across this as a little sidebar. We can. Joab, son of Zeruth, was over the army. Jehoshaphat, son of Ahud, was recorder. Zadok, son of Hatub, and Ahimelech, son of Abiathar, were priests. Sherea was secretary. Benaiah, son of Jehoah, was over the Kerethites and the Pelethites, and David's sons were priests. I think I've read things that says that is a, they were kind of like princes, and it was misinterpreted as priests. Obviously, they were the tribe of Judah. They weren't supposed to be priests. So,
there's three other versions that say royal advisor.
Okay, there you go. So I looked up and said, yeah, whatever. I tried to stick to the ESV on this one, and that I think they misinterpreted it. So what was interesting that you go back, and I was kind of like, who is this Zeruth? And you realize, so I found this. It is a website called Tactical Christianity, and I'll just read it real quick. King David's life and reign are so well documented in the Bible that many people involved, truly a cast of hundreds, can become confusing at times. But the identity of some of these individuals is important for understanding David's story. For example, the individual Zeruha is named a total of 26 times, twice as many times as Nehemiah, for example, in four separate books of the Old Testament. Zeruha also had three prominent sons, Joab, Abishai, and Ashiel. Who was Zeruah? The answer to this question is found in the genealogy of David, recorded in 1 Chronicles chapter 2, verses 3 through 16. This genealogical summary records that David had seven older brothers, also mentioned in 1 Samuel 16, 10 through 11, and two sisters. Zeruth was one of David's two sisters, and the three sons, Joab, Abishai, and Ashiel, were David's nephews. This explains a number of otherwise puzzling events or circumstances in David's reign. For example, 2 Samuel tells us that when David's son, we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, but David's son Absalom attempted to forcibly take the kingship and sought to kill his father, he made Amasa the commander of the Israelite army, even though Amasa led the forces that tried to overthrow and kill David at this time. Once Absalom had been defeated, King David retained Amasa as commander of the army in place of the previous commander, Joab, who had disobeyed David by killing Absalom. We might wonder why David would trust Amasa, but the answer to the question is found in 2 Samuel. Amasa was the son of a woman called Abigail, not David's wife. This Abigail was David's other sister, in addition to Zeruha, so Amasa was David's nephew also. This is why David asked Amasa, "Are you not my own flesh and blood?" Unfortunately for Amasa, Joab, the son of Zeruah, killed his cousin to regain his role as head of the army. The fact that Joab was David's nephew explains why David would not execute him despite his crimes, but had Solomon kill him. And Solomon did not have the same direct familial ties to the commander. Royal politics, as with many other aspects in life of the biblical world, were often driven by such family connections and relationships. Responsibilities to close family members were particularly strong, and it was rare for individuals in power to kill or even punish close relatives unless they were perceived as a direct threat. In this case, we have looked here, David did not only only would have to break his societal attitude if he had executed his nephews Amasa and Joab, but he would also have disgraced his own sisters by doing so. The identity of David's two sisters help us understand David's actions or lack of action on several occasions, and looking at the family connections involved can help us to understand the story, this story and others in the Old Testament kings. So, I don't know if anybody, what's very, very, again, the reason I stumbled across this is stressing Jesus is called a son of David. It seems like everything starts with David. The kingdom up to that point, Jesse, his father, is never mentioned. And it seems like the authors went out this way. They would have never used women's name in a genealogy. But they went out of their way to, it would have been the sons of their husbands, not her sons. So it seems like the Holy Spirit, in writing the Bible, went out of his way to start everything with David from here down. And I think for, I had an interesting childhood, it's a fair, but for me, it's a real, real cool thing that no matter what your family history is and where it's been, you can have the worst father, the worst mother, the worst brothers, the worst everything. When you get saved, he can start a new family line that begins with you, and you can change your family's history. You can make your family in a manner that would make
thousand
generations of decent people, as opposed to, because as human beings, I always abuse kids grow up to be abusers. And it's hard to believe. You would think, for the most part, that you know that if you were abused, you would not want that. But somehow in our genome and how human beings are wired, since that was modeled for you, that seems to be what you model. And I think there's a chance when Jesus Christ steps into your life that all that can change. He becomes your father then, and then he can model what comes after that. And I don't know, I just think that's a very, very important thing for me personally. This might just be something that doesn't answer to anybody else, but for me, stumbling across that and this, I think is very important, that he's willing to start with you and write a whole new genealogy that stops and begins with you. And I think that's really interesting, really cool. So that's Chris's soapbox in the morning.
But the way the monarchy sets up in his family, they put the most trust in there. It's really the same as what the Lord does. He sets up his family in positions. Like we were talking about earlier.
Yep.
He entrusts, so it's kind of the same thing.
And again, this hasn't caught up again. We're going to see, we got to remember, David's going to talk about the kingdom of David, but the kingdom of David is kind of a model for the kingdom of heaven and how it's expanded and how Christ, and God doesn't want to give you military victories over people, which it's a shame the church history is replete with people attempting to do that. You know, Christ wants you to expand that kingdom. You're here, and we're going to, I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but I would see a good example of that.
Let's go back to your statement with when did it start, the bad and how our government was set up. Well, it's just like as soon as it was set up, the people in their human nature look for ways to make it better for them through what the system is. And then even the people that signed it started saying, this is what's going to go, and this is how it's going to go wrong, because they started looking at it and seeing how it's, whatever's good is going to be attacked by evil, and that's, doesn't matter what it is.
Well, if you know anything about Patrick Henry and the Give Me Liberty, Patrick Henry fought to his last breath to stop the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
because he felt like that we were creating a centralized monster that was going to,
and it was right.
Yep. So, yeah. But where would we be if we had, you know, you can't go back and rewrite history and say, what if.
But the idea they set it up on was on God, Jesus. And that all works good as long as the people's mindsets
are moral
on God and Jesus instead of man.
And that's what happened. Agreed. So you're never going to have a perfect government.
Yes.
You know, you're never going to have a perfect church, and if you find one, don't go in. You'll mess them up. Right?
You got it.
So, you know, humans are involved. It's going to be problems. All right, so 2 Samuel 9. David asks, is there still anyone left of the house of Saul whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake? So this takes us back, hopefully everybody will remember, all the way back when Jonathan and David were crying and hugging in the field, and he says, you know, when you come into your kingdom, you know, don't forget me, take care of me, we've been friends. And David swore that, yeah, I'll take care of you and all your descendants. So David's upholding that part of the bargain. Now there was a servant of Saul's household named Ziba. They summoned him to appear before David, and the king said to him, are you Ziba? At your service, he replied. The king asked, is there no one still alive in the house of Saul whom I can show God's kindness? I think that's kind of important. Ziba answered to the king, there is still a son of Jonathan. He is lame in both feet. Where is he? The king asked Ziba. Answered. The king asked. Ziba answered. He is at the house of Machir, son of Amiel, in Lo-Debar. So King David had him brought from Lo-Debar, from the house of Machir, son of Amiel. When Mehisapheth, son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David, he bowed down to pay honor. And David said, Mehisapheth. And he said, at your service. So you can imagine how this guy feels. Under normal conditions, he's the last representative of the previous king. So he's the last representative from that family that has a claim to that throne. So normally, throughout history, what David would have done if he was anybody but David was to put him to death. Because that would then there would be no one left that could usurp the throne rightly from David or claim the throne. But it, so that's why it's kind of important. He said, don't be afraid, David said to him, for I will surely show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. I will restore to you all the land that belonged to your grandfather Saul, and you will always eat at my table. Mehisapheth bowed down and said, what is your servant that you should notice a dead dog like me? Then the king summoned Ziba, Saul's steward, and said to him, I have given your master's grandson everything that belonged to Saul and his family. You and your sons and your servants are to farm the land for him and bring in the crops, so that your master's grandson may be provided for. And Mehisapheth, grandson of your master, will always eat at my table. Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, your servant will do whatever the Lord my king commands his servant to do. So Mehisapheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. Mehisapheth had a young son named Micah, and all the members of Ziba's household were servants of Mehisapheth. And Mehisapheth lived in Jerusalem because he always ate at the king's table, for he was lame in both feet. You'll remember when Saul lost the battle which he was killed in, I guess the servant was afraid that the, did he lose the Amalekites, I think it was? That's terrible. All right. Whoever Saul lost to, I have to go back and look. The servant was afraid they would come to his house and see if they had been, he lost Jonathan, like he lost his whole family. He was afraid that they would come there and kill his last son. So the servant took off and started running. Well, she stumbled and fell, and she crippled the child. So that's how he has no, doesn't have use of his legs. That's why he's lame. And that's why he can say, you notice a dead dog like me. In that culture, if you were crippled, you were pretty much worthless. You were a drain on the family's resources, and you couldn't provide any benefit. So it's pretty interesting that, and too far ahead of ourselves, but you'll see Behizabeth make some bad decisions too. So 2 Samuel 10. After this, the king of the Ammonites died, and David and Hunan, his son, reigned in his place. And David said, I will deal loyally with Hunan, son of Nahish, as the father dealt loyally with me. So David sent his servants to console him concerning his father. And David's servants came into the land of the Ammonites. But the princes of the Ammonites said to Hanan, their lord, do you think because David has sent comforters to you that he is honoring your father? Has not David sent his servants to you to search the city and spy it out and overthrow it? So Hanan took David's servants and shaved off half the beard of each and cut off their garments in the middle at their hips and sent them away. So this is kind of the ultimate shaming. To be in that culture, you know, a man's beard was representative of him, and to be naked, basically, running home is, you know, very, very... So when it was told to David, he sent to meet them, for the men were greatly ashamed, and the king said, remain at Jericho until your beards have grown, and then return. So, just to camp here, and just to see if I can mesh this together with something else I was talking to Scott about this morning. So obviously when David would send people to, you were a representative, a diplomat or whatever, they would write things on a scroll. You would roll up the scroll, drop hot wax where the cook, and you would take, most of the time it was a ring, and the king would press his ring into that hot wax, and then what that basically symbolized, these people that are bringing you this paper are imagers of me. They are carrying my image, and you're to give them the respect that you would give me. And I just thought it was interesting. I was just listening to a guy this week that said, what do you think we are? Jesus took a bunch of clay off the face of the earth, made it wet, and impressed his image in it, and then sent you out. And now all the people, we think we get disrespected and we're timid about things, but think about the army and the power that you have behind you as that representative. And I think it's kind of, that always comes back to me. I always think about the when Jesus sent out the disciples, and he said, if you go somewhere and they don't accept you, dust off your feet. And that's because you're an imager of God. You're a representative of the kingdom. Wherever you go, the kingdom goes. And if you get somewhere and they don't want the kingdom, when you leave that, don't bring that dirt that's not the kingdom ground. Don't bring that soil back here. Leave it there. Get that dust off your feet, because that's not part of the kingdom. We didn't walk there. So I think it's a really, really cool picture here. And you're going to see, I mean, you could make the case that all throughout history, people have surrounded themselves with bad people. And we're seeing that in our government right now. And, I mean, they just make bad decisions. You'll see later when the kingdoms split in Israel that the king surrounds himself with bad advisors. Well, surrounding himself with bad advisors causes the split. You know, that, you know, you should seek out good counsel. That is a really, really big lesson in life, is finding. And for guys, I know for me, it's funny, I wouldn't even say who it was, they would never hear the tape, but, you know, one of my best friends has never got married and never had a kid, but he's been around kids, he's fun with kids, he's just a good guy, he's got a nice guy, everything. And my wife's like, well, why do you think he never had kids? I said, well, maybe he can't. She said, well, don't you think he would have told you that? I'm like, no. That's not the kind of stuff that guys talk about. We don't care. You know, so Yeah, it's just kind of funny how we can kind of, guys can just kind of isolate ourselves and really stay surface level in our relationships with people. And, you know, sometimes you need a relationship with some guys that's a little deeper than that, that you can reach out to. But we are, you know, we're just have a hard time doing that. A lot of guys do. I admit I do. Like I said, I've been friends with the guy most of my life, and I don't know why I didn't have kids. I never had. So, difference between women and men on that one. So, when the Ammonites saw they had become a stench to David, the Ammonites sent and hired the Syrians of Beth Rehob and the Syrians of Zobah, 20,000 foot soldiers, and the king of Makkah with 1,000 men, and the men of Pub, 12,000 men. I'm sorry about the pronunciations, but it is what it is. And when David heard of it, he sent Joab and all the host of the mighty men. And the Ammonites came out and drew up in a battle array at the entrance of the gate. And the Syrians of Zobah and Rehob and the men of Tob and Makkah were by themselves in the open country. So you basically have two sets of people. Some people obviously here close to the city, and some people out in the open field. And so when Jacob saw the battle was set against him both in the front and the rear, he chose some of the best men of Israel and raided them against the Syrians. The rest of the men he put in charge of Abishai, his brother, and he arrayed them against the Ammonites. And he said, "If the Syrians are too strong for me, then you shall help me. But if the Ammonites are too strong for you, then I will come to help you. Be of good courage, and let us be courageous for our people and for the cities of our God, and may the Lord do what seems good to him." So, you know, for all, Joab's an interesting character. Again, nobody's, that's why you could, I mean, you could really, really trust the Bible in the sense that, you know, Joab's not some kind of superhero that's always doing things wrong, nor is he a villain that's always doing things, you know, bad, or, you know, and it's just, they're people making decisions based on the information or whatever they have at their disposal at these moments. But right here you can say, "And may the cities of our God, and may the Lord do what seems good to him." So it's kind of putting it in the Lord's hands, which is always a good thing. So Joab and the people who were with him drew near to battle against the Syrians, and they fled before him. And when the Ammonites saw that the Syrians had fled, they likewise fled before Abishai and entered the city. And when Joab returned from fighting against the Ammonites and came to Jerusalem, but when the Syrians saw they had been defeated by Israel, they gathered themselves together, and Hadazar sent and brought the Syrians who were beyond the Euphrates. They came to Helam with Sobach, the commander of the army of Hadazar, at the head. And when it was told to David, he gathered all Israel together across the Jordan and came to Helam, and the Syrians arrayed themselves against David and fought with him. And the Syrians fled before Israel. David killed of the Syrians the men of 700 chariots and 40,000 horsemen, and wounded Sobach, the commander of the army, so that he died there. And when all the kings who were servants of Hadadezer saw they had been defeated by Israel, they made peace with Israel and became subject to them, so the Syrians were afraid to save the Ammonites anymore. So I don't know if the word "to save the Ammonites anymore" is the right word. I would say "come to their aid" might be better, but they certainly didn't save them. But this goes back, it's kind of weird, just some of this is back on that map I showed you. This is just kind of a replay of some of that things that went on with the battles of David. So, let me see. I got to save 2 Samuel 11 because obviously that's a pretty... So, you kind of get the feeling with chapter 10 that we've kind of... David's rule and reign is kind of apexed, in a sense, because some bad things are, you're going to see him have his own personal problems, his family becomes a wreck, I mean, there's many things from here on down. It's kind of a roller coaster ride down the hill. So, but hopefully there was something in there for today's, instead of just reading. I know some of it's hard not to just read that they went out and fought this, and I could make an allegory about the victories you're going to have, but I don't see that in there, to be honest with you. So, anybody have any comments, anything?
I to read the 1,000 generations. A lot of people, you know, generational curses, and they talk about all this stuff, but the Lord stops it like you were talking about. It says, therefore know the Lord your God. He is God, a faithful God, who keeps his covenant and merciful for 1,000 generations with those who love him and keep his commandments. And he repays those who hate him to their face to destroy them. He will not be slack with him who hates him. He will repay him to his face. It's like a lot of people, God's not going to punish someone else's for someone else's sin. And I know a lot of people act like, oh, because I have this, this, and this, that's why I'm that way. It's just an excuse because you're choosing not to surrender.
Yep.
Yes. Deuteronomy 7, 9, and 10.
Thank you.
Yeah, sometimes it's an excuse just to, you know, and we're all made of, what, 80% water, and that's always seeking the easiest path to follow. So, you know, it's easy to, you know, the devil made me do it, or, you know, all that kind of. Some of it's just us. And, again, you know, I that's, like, the most awesome thing that the Lord can start with you. He doesn't need